Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Percival Everett is having a moment, as they say. His book Erasure was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film American Fiction, and his new novel James is being hailed as a new classic of our literature. In James, Everett retells the story of Jim, the enslaved character from the Mark Twain novel The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It's a remarkable book, both a ripping picaresque with the characteristics of a Western and an exploration of the racial categories that haunt this country's people and institutions. We talked to Everett about the philosophy of language, his conversation with Twain, and the meaning of anger. That's all coming up next, right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking this morning with the author Percival Everett about his new book, James, which occurs in Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn universe but stands distinct from it. James centers the voice and experience of the character Twain called Jim, who was enslaved where Finn grew up. Everett has been a finalist for the Pulitzer and Booker Prizes, is a distinguished professor in the English department at USC. And he also wrote a book about a baby with an IQ of 475 and another one called A History of the African American People, proposed by Strom Thurmond, as told to Percival Everett and James Kincaid. He's got range, is what I'm saying. Welcome to the show, Percival.
Thank you.
So, you know, this book, like Huck Finn, is a Mississippi River book. You grew up in South Carolina. You live in Southern California now. How'd you become acquainted with the river in this kind of Missouri territory?
Oh, I can't claim to any expertise about the river at all. I've visited and been there several times, but I really can't lay claim to special knowledge.
Do you like that particular kind of biome and region, or are you more of an arid Westerner?
Well, I think I'm more of an arid Westerner. I'm a desert rat. It's too green there for me.
Too many bugs, too many snakes, too much humidity.
Yeah, a lot of snakes where you don't expect them.
Let's talk about the first time that you encountered the book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Like, do you remember, did you read it in school? Did you pick it up after?
Well, I remember reading an abridged version when I was 7 or 8, and I don't know what made it abridged. It's just shorter than the other one. And I wasn't overly impressed with it. It was just an adventure story. I really didn't like Tom Sawyer at all.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I did warm up to the Huck Finn tale. And later, as a teenager, I read it. And as a black American teenager, you can understand that it was somewhat problematic. But still, I could see the importance of the novel.
Yeah. Why did it become meaningful to you, do you think?
Well, Twain was important to me. He reading Life on the Mississippi and Roughing It as a kid, a lot of my humor and my sense of irony was influenced by Twain. And the novel is set in opposition to slavery. It uses the vernacular. It's actually difficult to read if you're not used to reading accents. But it's the first time in literature where there's a character, a young boy, who represents a young America, an adolescent America, wandering through his own landscape, trying to come to terms with probably the most defining characteristic of the American experience, which is race.
Mm. You know, in your version of this book, you kind of time shift us from, I guess, what we called Jacksonian America sometimes, mm-hmm. forward to the kind of opening months of the Civil War. I mean, what did that shift do for the book?
Well, it was playing into the impending freedom that was possible, even though the character James doesn't know it's coming. It appears sort of like an apparition at the end of the novel. Also, it's playing into the adventurous spirit of Huck Finn. He is, as a child, entranced by the idea of battle and war, and it just underscores his inexperience and his just being lost in a world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you began to approach, you know, Huckleberry Finn again in order to write this novel, what was your actual kind of ingestion process for bringing that Twain world into yourself?
Well, I wanted to inhabit the world and not the text. So I had to divorce myself from Twain's text, which is quite, you know, that's amazing. You know, the novel has its problems, but it's a very strong voice. And in order to do that, I read Huck Finn 15 times in a row, and I would end it and go back to the beginning. I wanted it to become a blur. I wanted the world, but not the words. Mm-hmm. And finally, the fourth or fifth reading, I was so sick of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I will never read it again now, and I don't encourage. This is an exercise I don't encourage anyone to partake.
Yeah. When did you decide you could be done? You know, that feels like a task you set out before yourself.
Well, I arbitrarily chose the number 15. If I, and only so I would be just completely sick of it. and this was to own the material.
Yeah. Yeah. What other reading did you do around it? Did you read a lot of what, you know, people call slave narratives? Did you do historical reading about, you know, the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s?
Well, I did. And I read some rather, you know, sort of amateurish books written by people from and around the area of Hannibal, Missouri, trying to get a sense of what the history of that place was like. And some of it was actually pretty good, and none of it was terribly profitable. I ended up reading a lot of Enlightenment philosophers, because Jefferson was someone I was taking on in this, but Jefferson really didn't leave any philosophy to talk about. So I ended up rereading a lot of Locke and Voltaire.
Yeah, these characters kind of appear at difficult moments for James in the book. And then they kind of wither before him as he brings sort of the horrors of slavery to the Enlightenment, you know, brings these two, the thinking and the reality into the same space. What did you take away from the Enlightenment philosophers that you still want to hold on to?
Well, you know, the arguments for the equality of all people are profound and suspect, obviously. And it's, you know, it's even Voltaire, with whom I might have a lot in common and I might enjoy an evening's dinner with hedges when it comes to real equality between people, where in his philosophy all men are equal, but not quite, because it's an equality that can be achieved. And with the admission that Europeans
have achieved it already,
we're more evolved than those who might achieve it.
You know, I think about Jamaica Kincaid has an amazing Instagram of her garden, and in that garden, she has a statue of Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, really?
And she posted it, and she wrote, "He did some bad things, but he wrote some greater things. The bad things he did are not a footnote. They're the foundation and inspiration for the good and great things he wrote. I think about it like once a week for the last like year.
Yeah, out of confusion?
Or? Out of confusion a little bit. Yeah, out of confusion. You didn't decide to directly tackle Jefferson, but that he's, you know, haunting that those parts of the book.
Well, yes, and I couldn't because, again, he didn't leave any philosophy for James to discover in the library of Judge Thatcher. Mm-hmm. And the suspect document that Jefferson did pen is not an argument. It's an assertion, albeit founded on some shaky ground as far as he's concerned. Again, the basic premises are wonderful and correct. It's the employment of them that's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about at least what I've heard about how you wrote this book, which was in a notebook with episodes of the TV show Mission Impossible on a loop in the background. Can that possibly be true?
Well, it can possibly be true, and sadly is. I use the television as white noise often when I'm working, because I can't use music because I listen to music. Well, there's some music I can use, but the narrative that's playing in a loop around me, I can return to it, and it's a kind of a comfort thing. What I found with the Mission Impossible, not to get too much into my own head, is that these shows are really well written. The old television, this 1960s television, they're really well written. And I'm amazed by the fact that they're exactly the same formula every time.
Like Law and Order, yeah.
Yeah, but completely different. Yeah. And but more different than Law and Order, which I've only seen a couple of times and stopped watching, mainly because of John Mulaney.
So one question about the format of this book. I mean, is it fun to write this kind of picaresque? Because on a plot level, you know, when you want two people to come together, you can just sort of do a Candide and they show up in the same place whenever you want them.
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my mind around this idea of fun writing. No, I mean, obviously I must get something out of it, else why would I do it over and over again, except for the fact that, of course, is the definition of insanity. You know, doing the same thing over and over again, hoping to get a different result. No, it was, when I'm working on something, I feel like I understand some part of the world. And I think I'm exploring that thing, and I'm completely open to it changing. But at the end of every book, I realize that I was wrong. I don't know anything about the world.
So you have to do it again.
So I have to do it again. And you know, and I love that feeling of not knowing anything. And I've written a lot of books, so I know less than most people.
We're talking with the author Percival Everett about his new book, James, which recenters the story of Huck Finn. Everett's a prolific author, Pulitzer Prize finalist, winner of numerous literary awards, English professor at USC. I'd love to hear from you. What are your questions for Percival Everett, a man who apparently knows less than you? You can email forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels, or you can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We've got Percival Everett with us this morning. Prolific author. His new book is James, which recenters the story of Huck Finn on Jim, as he's known in Mark Twain's book. Percival, you said in the past that you want to write an abstract novel in the way that like a painting can be abstract. And I've been thinking about that for the last few days and wondering, like, is that not like a book of poems? Like, if you take out the representational aspects of a novel, like the character and the plot, aren't you left with just the power of language alone as the poets would see it?
That'd be pretty bad poems. you know, even poems rely not necessarily on narrative, but on concrete images. You know, words are necessarily representational. And that's the problem I have in this kind of sort of ill-framed and misguided attempt to make such a novel. I think I ought to be able to do it, but
what would the texture of that be, though?
If you could tell me, that would help me a lot.
I'll work on it. I'll get back to you. You know, about 10 years ago, a group of scholars put together a book about you called Perspectives on Percival Everett, which must be fun to have a book like that. And they set it up like this. On the one hand, Everett is an African-American novelist. On the other hand, he pursues subject matters that seemingly have little to do with African-American culture. The operative word here is seemingly, for as these essays demonstrate, Everett's work falls within as well as outside of what most critics would deem the African-American literary tradition. How have you seen your relationship to that tradition?
Well, first of all, the argument, the discussion proceeds with some missteps. I don't know what that means, an African-American tradition, as opposed to an American tradition. Mm-hmm. As soon as you enter that discussion, you've marginalized somebody. It's like relegating the history of slavery to black people. Mm-hmm. The history of slavery is more a history of white crime than it is black victimhood. So there's plenty to share here. Also, it creates this myth that black people are in America are all the same, that there is one African-American experience. And even as I say African-American experience, there are American experiences that are experienced by black people, by African Americans, and those are as wide and varied as those experienced by white Americans. The whole language of race is problematic and bogus and creates untrue categories. Hmm.
You know, one listener, I mean, that's the point you just made, is one lesson one might take from your novel, Erasure. And the listener asked, you know, I love the movie American Fiction. I wondered if Everett ever found himself pigeonholed as an African-American author, similar to the way the character in the book Erasure and the film American Fiction found himself. I think we can safely answer that there has been an aspect of that in your career, yeah?
Oh, sure. And every writer of color has experienced this. You know, the question one has to ask any time is, would you ask this of a white writer? The incidents that I experienced was I had a publisher turn down a novel of mine, my novel Frenzy, you know, and to prove that I have my finger pressed firmly against the pulse of American popular culture, it's about the Greek god Dionysus. This person came up to me and said that they turned down my book. And I said, well, that's fine. You know, that happens. And they said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. And he said, what does this have to do with black people?
Mm.
And I thought, oh, gee, I wonder if you would have asked that of Bernard Malamud. What does Dionysus have to do with Jews?
Mm.
Or mm-hmm. John Updike, what does Dionysus have to do with uptight wasps? And therein lies the problem. And my answer was everything.
Yeah. You know, in your life, you know, when we talk about race as, you know, defining fact of this country, the racial picture of America has changed a lot. Just in your life alone, you know, you live in Los Angeles, you know, there's tons of Latinos, there's different Asian groups. Has adding these other dimensions of the American racial picture, like, what do you think it's done to the kind of underlying and maybe preceding black-white divisions?
Well, it's been profitable for the status quo, certainly, because everyone can point to everyone else and say, look, they have the same problems. Mm-hmm. And it's a diffusing tactic. It's, again, the failure is to fall into the language. There's no racial differences between any of the people you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There are cultural differences, there are geographic mm-hmm. differences. And there are language differences, but right. race was a category abandoned by anthropologists at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. There's no foundation for that.
Yeah. Listeners have some praise coming in for the book, James, people who've read it. Judd writes, I just finished Percival Everett's James. It was surreal, compelling, sad, tragicomic read. All the racial ins and outs reminded me of an old phrase from way back when. If you're black, step back. If you're brown, stick around. If you're white, you're all right. That said, I highly recommend reading James. Hope there's a film adaptation in the works. Michaela has a different kind of question. She just wants to know, you know, kind of what's the structure of this book? You know, she hasn't read it yet and wants to know how James can end up meeting the Enlightenment in, you know, this kind of adventure story in the 19th century.
Oh, I can't tell you. you know, it's like the Mississippi River. I can tell you that it's full of water and that there's some snakes in there, but you can't see it from my telling you about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one answer to Michaela's question is that the jumping off point of Huckleberry Finn is sort of where James begins, right? This meeting on this island between Huckleberry Finn and James.
They start at pretty much the same place, the two novels. But yes, it's their dire circumstances. Huck fleeing his abusive father by faking his murder, and Jim escaping because he's afraid he'll be sold away from his family.
Mm-hmm. And James has, you know, taught himself to read, write from the library of Judge Thatcher. But of course, he's kind of hiding his intelligence and teaching those skills and to the children in this enslaved community. You know, what do you think about the lesson that sort of James is imparting? I mean, I think he says safe movement through the world dependent on mastery of language and fluency.
Well, that's the information, language, reading. That's the avenue to freedom. It's the avenue to, you know, all of that's the thing that's missing in the popular conception of perception of slavery is everybody thinks that all slaves did was they ate, had babies, and loved and hated people. That's it. They were complicated people. They were people. Their emotions had the same range of any character that you would have in any novel from Jane Austen or Henry James. And so I wasn't as so much trying to give James agency by giving him literacy, but giving him an avenue to express his own agency.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, thinking if we were to read back into the sorts of things that James is doing in this book, people might refer to that as, you know, quote unquote, code switching. What do you think about that term as a way of like describing when people, you know, shift their language to the audience?
Well, people like to use terms that make it sound like we've just discovered that. Yeah, this is as old as humanity. Oppressed, enslaved, imprisoned people find a way to talk to each other in the presence of their enemies without their enemies having any entry to that talk. That's just normal. And so my characters here, and the default language for them happens to be standard English because this is literary. Who knows what that language would have been? Who knows what their language that they shared privately would have sounded like? But it would have been issued with the kind of intelligence that human beings have, with the kind of complexity about emotions, about thoughts that all human beings have. And so when they are alone, the slaves, they speak, the enslaved people speak standard English. But that would be terrifying to a population of white people who depend on the fact that the enslaved are less human. And so they have to speak in a way that betrays their own intelligence.
We're talking with author Percival Everett about his new book, James, which recenters the story of Huck Finn. Everett's a prolific author, Pulitzer Prize and Booker Prize finalist, and an English professor at USC. We're going to get to more of your questions for Percival Everett. The email address is forum@kqed.org. You can give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You know, in this book, writing becomes incredibly powerful for James, and even he kind of argues to himself that if these words could have meaning, then life itself could have meaning. Can you talk a little bit more about writing and even language's kind of relationship to meaning for you?
Well, one of the reasons I write at all is I'm fascinated by the probably the most rudimentary part of being human, which is that I can make meaning. Mm-hmm. I can utter these phonemes here, or I can make marks on a page and give them to you, and you can understand something. That's amazing to me. Mm-hmm. They're just little marks, but the even more amazing part is you might understand what I'm trying to convey to you, but you might also understand something that I didn't even mean. Mm. That gives me a headache as soon as I start thinking about it. And the other thing about this, even though we all share language, reading is the most subversive thing we can do. When we read something, even if someone's looking at the very same text over your shoulder, it means what it means to you, and no one knows what you're bringing to it and what you're creating while you read it, which is why, you know, fascist regimes move so quickly to banning and burning books. It's terrifying to anyone who would want to control you that you might have thoughts that are your own.
Hmm. Let's bring in a caller. Let's bring in Kirsten in Martinez. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi, Kirsten.
Hello?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. My question was, could you please expound a little bit on the significance of the pencil?
In this book, yeah. For listeners, James ends up getting a pencil via another enslaved person. And it's referenced in a lot of the reviews of this book, right? That this pencil moment. So, yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about it.
Well, you know, we take certain things for granted. We can always find a pen or a pencil and paper, but what if you couldn't? Mm-hmm. And what if you needed to write to preserve your sanity, your agency, your world? the pencil becomes pretty important. And they weren't so easily available. I tried to imagine myself, and when I was sort of coming to the importance of the pencil, I imagined myself on a desert island with nothing to write with. What would I do? Obviously, it'd be charcoal or something, but I would have to find or fashion something to use. So that small thing that I take for granted every day would become very important very quickly.
Because writing itself, right, allows you to like extend thinking in ways that are just kind of hard to do if you're keeping it all in your head, right?
So it turns out, Socrates actually thought writing was a terrible thing, that it would get in the way of thought. It would reduce the need for thought. Maybe if he had been writing a little more, he wouldn't have had to have that fatal drink. But there's a huge difference between, as Jim James says in the novel, between relating your story to someone, telling your story to someone, and writing it yourself.
Yeah. Right, because that was sort of one of the conventions of the so-called slave narratives of the 19th century, published by white abolitionists in the North, usually to say related by, right?
Yes. And which often meant, I'm going to make this up for someone.
Yeah. And did you find any, between those types of narratives, did you find any that had more of kind of like the sweat and of humanity on it? Or did you find mostly these things that had been kind of purified by these white abolitionists?
Well, I didn't read enough of them to really comment on that. Obviously, Frederick Douglass is a great, he wrote it. I mean, that's the difference. And then there's something like Venture Smith that is referenced in the novel, which has some things of memory that are suspect, but I can't discount them, of being a very young child, yet remembering all the names and places of your ancestors before you were taken into slavery. And it sounds remarkable, but perhaps it's true.
Yeah. A listener, we were just mentioning book banning. Huck Finn has been pulled, maybe not banned exactly, but it's been pulled out of a school libraries and other things. And a listener asks, it's strange to see the N-word used in literature as it's used throughout Huck Finn. I know some versions of Huck Finn replace the word with slave. What do you think?
Well, you can't clean up hatred. And you can't clean up racism. And what does it mean to replace that word? Because it has power. And when someone uses that word, you know who you're dealing with. You know where you are. And they don't have the same meaning. They are not the same word. So in Huck Finn, the word belongs there because it is the language of the people at the time. Can it be a hard word to read? Well, of course. And likewise, I use the word in the novel for that very reason. You have to know who you're dealing with. I would much rather wander into some small town and hear them use the word than find out later that they were using it secretly. Mm. It's a marker. It's a sign at the edge of a minefield that says mines.
Yeah, the point is that the point is it's hard to read it, from our perspective. We're talking with the author Percival Everett about his new book, James, which recenters the story of Huck Finn. Also, of course, the author of the novel Erasure, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film American Fiction. We'll get to more of your questions for Percival Everett. You can email forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
Yes.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're joined by author Percival Everett. New book out is called James, being widely hailed as a new American classic. Everett, listener Mia writes in to say, I heard about Percival Everett when Barack Obama put one of his books on his year-end reading list. I've read and enjoyed many of his books, especially those set in the Southwest. And what I wanted to ask you out of this comment is, There's a way in which James can be read as a Western, though it's not set in what we would now call the West. Do you think of it like that?
I never did, but I'm trying to think of what isn't a Western.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, you know, as soon as you have people moving into any space, fleeing any kind of danger, you've sort of mapped out a Western. And Westerns are, though set in a certain place, which makes them Westerns, are really just the old novels of chivalry. Mm-hmm. It's not a new form. It's a different spirit in a new location, but the form is already there.
Right. That's why they can work just as well in like a Kurosawa film or like Italian movie. Yeah. Let's bring in David in Martinez.
Hi. I read a fascinating profile in the New Yorker of Percival Everett, and I was wondering if he could recount the story of the crow that he nursed back to health.
I want to hear this one too, Percival.
Oh.
Thanks, David.
A crow fell out of a nest. I used to I'd have a ranch near L.A., and and a crow fell from a nest, and I couldn't get him back into his nest. And so I raised him, and I wanted him to go off and do crow things, you know.
Talking with other crows.
Yeah, you know, having
math, symbolic language.
Crow dates. And every time I would throw him into the air, he would fly in a very large circle and land right back beside me and just walk. And so he lived with me for 2 years. His name was Jim. And crows are monogamous, and so he wouldn't allow my dogs to come near me. Anyone who came near me, he would spread his wings, sitting on my shoulder, and squawk at them. So it was, it's a great companion. He was on my shoulder when I wrote the novel Erasure. And if I stopped paying attention to him, he would march down my arm and peck at the keys. So I credit him with writing some of it.
He fell in love with you. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, you know, and likewise. But I still, we had to break up. I kept telling him.
Let's bring in Lynn in San Francisco. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you. First of all, it's an honor to chat with you. I got a copy of your book and couldn't put it down. Totally fascinating, the style of writing, the expression, and the enjoyment of Jim actually, I'm going to say bilingual at that point. And your description of Norman, I'm Norman in that book. That's my active life. I go through life as Norman, and it's interesting your insight into that character, and wondering how you developed that being a black man yourself.
Well, thank you for the, all the kind words. It's very nice. Norman's position is not an uncommon one. It never has been. There are, you know, what does it mean to be black? It has nothing to do with skin color. It has to do with ancestry. And if one has to ask oneself, if there's danger afoot, do you wear camouflage? Or do you stay hidden? And how do you identify? These are all questions that are well above my pay grade. I'm just a novelist.
Just for listeners, Norman is a light-skinned black man who moves through the world. How would you describe it? How would you describe how he moves?
He's passing for white.
Yeah.
Again, which is something that a lot of people can do. Some people choose to do, and many don't. Growing up in the South, I grew up with black people who had blonde hair and blue eyes.
Yeah. Tom writes to say, you know, where did the idea of the horridly ironic minstrel show incident and the white and black facial makeup come from? Is it based on an actual story or a creation of your own mind? Maybe you could set up a tiny bit about what has happened in the novel for James to find himself as part of a minstrel show.
Well, James has found himself in the employ, we'll say. He is now owned by a man in a livery stable who needs, for reasons that the novel creates, he needs a blacksmith. And he sings for a while, and he is heard singing by Daniel Decatur Emmett, who was the man who is credited for having written the song Dixie and wrote a lot of wonderfully offensive songs. And when he hears James singing, he needs a tenor. His tenor has run away from his troupe. And he has a minstrel troupe of white men who dress themselves in blackface and perform for white people, making fun of slaves. And he hears James sing and hires him, or buys him. He tells James that he's being hired, but that becomes a distinction without a difference later. And as they are a minstrel troupe, James has to perform with them. So he's made up in blackface to appear to be a white man, dressing up in blackface to pretend to be a black man. His makeup is actually applied by Norman, who is a white passing black man. And they share language, which is how they discovered that they're both black.
You know, in this book, anger kind of grows within James as time goes on. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what anger means. Like, not just what it is as a feeling, but like, what do you think it means?
Yeah. You know, I'm just a cowboy. what anger means. Well, yeah. There's a difference between outrage and rage, and given circumstances, one can precede the other. Better to have outrage follow rage, and that way you can move towards some change, perhaps. But maybe that's true of the converse. We as a culture, we have, in especially in the United States, we have a 10-day shelf life for outrage. Something bad will happen and we'll all be upset for 10 days and then it goes away. Something else replaces it. Not necessarily another thing of outrage. It could be the Super Bowl. It could be any number of things. But we don't stay mad, which is why often change doesn't happen. or happens very slowly. Mm. So for the character James, his first feeling is fear of losing his family. And as that, and as the treatment of the world becomes more pronounced and it creates greater distance from him and his family, he becomes enraged. And I think at the end, it's that rage and his sense of outrage about how all of his people are being treated leads to a certain action.
We have a listener, Isaac, who writes in to say, you know, when I was reading Adventures of Huck Finn in high school, I remember having a conversation with my dad about it, and he believed that the liminality of the Mississippi made it possible for Huck to be able to connect with Jim and see him as a person in a way that Huck would otherwise not have been able to in society. I haven't read James yet, but I was wondering if that idea of the water is the same in your mind, or if there's a similar aspect in the novel.
Well, the water serves as a boundary between bad places. So, yes, there's that. It's also, it's an avenue. It's moving. It gives movement to the story. It gives movement to the relationship. But there's a lot of even Huck Finn where Jim and James are separated. Of course, as a novelist, that was my window into Jim's world when Huck isn't present. So yes, it does tie them together, though it wouldn't take much to imagine that a desert would as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they kind of function like an ocean in that way, at least, you know, yeah, at that time in history, for sure. Let's bring in Mary Molly in San Francisco.
Hello. I feel so privileged to be able to talk to you. I'm sorry, I'm a recent fan.
Well, thank you.
I saw American Fiction, and it was like the mystery movie, so I didn't know what I was watching, and I loved it, and I went to see it two more times in the theater, bringing different people with me. And then I read Erasure, and
kept going.
Then I read, I kept going, Dr. No, and The Trees, which was brutal but so good, and The Trees actually made me think it needs to be made into like a movie by M. Night Shyamalan. And then Telephone, and I love, you really seem to capture people who like are on the autism spectrum, like in Dr. No. I loved it. It was so funny. And then I also love your I don't want to call them like an abrupt ending, but it winds things up, but it leaves a lot for the reader to wind up in their head. You know, you give us that framework of, you know, like in Telephone when it's ending, is it okay for me to, am I going to ruin it for anybody who hasn't read it yet?
I'm okay with it.
but I love how, you know, I mean, it was this the tragic story of the professor that was the geologist who loved rocks, yeah, and stuff, and his daughter who is, you know, now in a care home, mm-hmm, you know, dying, and you just see that the love, that, you know, commitment with his wife, even there's the questions, and then, you know, him being concerned about those women who were in slavery and, yeah, you know, creating clothing, you know, and his bravery. Here he is. He's sort of this, I don't want to call him like a geeky professor, but, you know, he's a professor. He likes rocks, you know. He's not a bodybuilder. He's not, you know, he doesn't study.
Who doesn't like rocks, though, Mary Molly, you know? thank you so much. I super appreciate this call. I mean, I wanted to focus in on something you said, which is just about writing people who we might call neurodivergent now, right? People who might be on the autism spectrum. Like, how have you thought about that? Thank you so much, Mary.
Well, I'm sure probably it's true of most artists, but I'm sure I fall on the spectrum somewhere. You know, I kind of see it, and as I watch kids who are on the spectrum, the way their minds work, I think they're the next evolutionary step. I just think that Once we humans have a handle on understanding this, we'll see that this is the way to be. I just think their minds are working a lot harder than mine, and probably seeing all sorts of things that I'm not capable of seeing.
Taking less shortcuts.
Yes.
Yeah. A listener writes in, you know, I haven't read James yet, but having read Erasure and seen American Fiction recently, my question is, how does anger inform Percival's writing? Specifically, I wonder if he thinks his novel within a novel in Erasure is truly terrible, or did that voice unlock something true about anger and the consequences that it brings?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things I learned about the novel within the novel is about the power of fiction, the power of art. No, I hate that novel in the novel, but my aim in making it was not to condemn such novels. It was to underscore the fact that only such novels were available. So I'm not mad that when people read anything, read something, one thing you can be sure of, people who want to ban books don't read books. Mm-hmm. And if they do read books, they're not understanding the books. Where was I? I'm sorry.
No, you were just talking about the novel within the novel.
Oh, yeah. I hated going to work on it because it's not the sort of thing I read. But when I finished it, I realized, well, it has some power. It does some work because it is a story. All stories can do work. I can't judge what the story will do for or to someone else. Stories have that kind of power. They're important. And I don't care where they come from as long as they get to people.
You know, I've heard you say that you imagine this book. I think you say, you know, I flatter myself that I'm in conversation with Mark Twain. What do you, with writing this book, what do you think Twain would make of this book? Like, what's that conversation look like?
Well, first of all, I hope that he doesn't say to me what he said about Henry James, which is, once you put one of his books down, you can't pick it up. I think he would like it. From what I know of his humor and his thinking about humanity and you know, it's an interesting question because it requires my taking the step that he would be able to leap over all the cultural changes that have happened from his time to this. If he were a product of this time with his mind, I think we would be in agreement. But I don't know about a mid-19th century person. I do certainly know that he would be capable of understanding the project.
Last comment. This one's definitely for you, Percival. A listener writes, when I first heard James was about Jim, I honestly was not interested. I was the only black kid in my school, and the drama teacher selected Huck Finn as a play. I remember feeling anger, shame, and frustration. But after hearing Mr. Everett speak, I think he's brilliant in developing Jim into James. We've been talking with author Percival Everett about his new book, James, which of course recenters the story of Huck Finn. Thank you so much for joining us, Percival.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Love all the things that you listeners brought to this conversation. Thank you so much. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Form Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.